This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 18th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, we go to Copenhagen, where negotiators scramble to reach a deal on the final day of negotiations. In Pakistan, pressure grows on President Zardari after this week's Supreme Court decision ends amnesty for political leaders.
It puts them under a severe threat of arrest and prosecution, and so many of them might be inclined to resign from office.
And we'll go to Oaxaca, Mexico, where a water crisis has residents coming up with some creative solutions. Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A Western Saharan activist is on her way back home today after more than a month on hunger strike. After receiving a human rights award in the U.S., Aminatou Haider attempted to re-enter Western Sahara, a disputed territory controlled by Morocco. But the Moroccan government confiscated her passport and denied her entry. Haider is part of a Western Saharan movement for self-determination. She began her hunger strike while stuck in an airport on the Canary Islands. Before boarding a plane for Western Sahara, Haider told reporters, "This is a triumph for international law, for human rights, for international justice, and for the cause." She says she will end her strike when she arrives home. A court in the UK has blocked an announced strike by British Airways cabin crews, saying the union vote was illegal because it included former British Airways employees. The workers intended to strike for 2 weeks over the December holidays, grounding planes and potentially affecting a million travelers. The Unite Union says it will reschedule a strike vote, which could allow a walkout at the beginning of 2010. Today, militants on the Gaza side of the border with Egypt opened fire on Egyptian construction workers. No injuries were reported, but the incident demonstrates the growing tensions between the two sides as initial speculation about underground border wall construction by Egypt is confirmed. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
The wall is allegedly intended to shut off underground tunnels that connect Egypt with Gaza in an attempt to prevent smuggling of goods and commodities into the coastal territory. The Egyptian government denies reports that the wall is being built, but Palestinian sources in Gaza confirm that large machines have been brought to the border. On Thursday, the Hamas-linked Shihab News Agency posted an image of the machinery, and the International Middle East Media Center reports that the UN relief agency's Karin Abu Zaid confirmed construction of the wall at a speech in Cairo. She also said the US is financially backing the project. Gaza's borders have been closed by Israel for more than 2 years. As a result, the UN estimates that underground tunnels make up 60% of economic activity for Gaza's 1.5 million residents. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
A new report shows 2009 saw more executions in the United States than last year, even as jurors handed down fewer death sentences. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
The Death Penalty Information Center's 2009 report shows jurors handed down fewer death sentences this year than in any year since the punishment was reinstated in 1976. Even so, more inmates were executed this year than last. The increase follows a backlog from 2008, when many states imposed a moratorium while waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to determine if lethal injection was cruel and unusual. The high cost of the death penalty led New Mexico to abolish executions, and in 2009, Colorado, Montana, Maryland, Kansas, and Connecticut all considered bills to end or restrict capital punishment. The report also noted that 9 men who had been sentenced to death were exonerated and freed over the past year. Renee Feltz, Free Speech Radio News.
Today is the 30th anniversary of the UN's adoption of CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. 186 countries have ratified CEDAW, but the United States still has not. Andrew Stelzer reports.
The so-called Bill of Rights for Women compels participating countries to protect women against discrimination, incorporate principles of equality into their legal systems, and abolish laws which stand in the way. Although not perfect, the successes of the UN Treaty have often come when activists or judges use it as leverage to defend their positions during a legal battle. The U.S. is one of seven countries that have not yet ratified CEDAW. Krishanti Dharmaraj is the co-founder of the Women's Institute for Leadership Development for Human Rights, a group that lobbied the U.S. government for years to ratify the convention.
What CEDAW would actually do is improve existing standards within the United States for women, such as women having, people having actually parental leave. It would look at pay equity for women, equity in the workplace, ability to access mortgages and loans.
Frustrated with the lack of progress, the city of San Francisco signed on to CEDAW in 1998. Since then, it's been used in the government to push for the hiring of more women, the creation of programs for young women in the juvenile justice system, and making it easier for street artists with childcare responsibilities to sell their wares. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, San Francisco.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Determined not to go home empty-handed, world leaders have reportedly agreed to stay overnight in Copenhagen to continue the climate change negotiation. A central part of that final negotiation is President Obama's demand that developing countries agree to participate in an emissions reporting and verification mechanism. Obama spoke earlier today in a much-anticipated speech.
We know the fault lines because we've been imprisoned by them for years. These international discussions have essentially taken place now for almost two decades. And we have very little to show for it other than an increase, acceleration, of the climate change phenomena. The time for talk is over. This is the bottom line. We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor, one that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren.
Obama reiterated the U.S. bottom line on cuts, which he has described as a realistic reduction, cutting emissions by 17% by 2020 and by more than 80% by 2050. After the speech, many environmentalists criticized Obama's hard line. FSRN's Jenny Johnson has more from the Bella Center in Copenhagen.
Once hopeful that U.S. President Obama might somehow transform the floundering negotiation, environmentalists say they're disappointed with Obama's speech Friday before scores of world leaders. Critics say Obama laid out a my way or the highway approach that would only further hinder the process. One of the terms Obama focused on is a demand for reporting and verification of emissions reductions by developing countries. He said transparency is a fundamental need in a new agreement, and no deal could be signed without it. Democratic Representative Henry Waxman of California arrived in Copenhagen yesterday. He backed Obama and said China must agree to independent emissions verification or there is no deal.
One of the reasons we may not get an agreement is China's intransigence that we should just believe them when they say they're going to reduce carbon emissions, and we should just accept their say-so about it, and they should have no binding requirements placed on them as would be on others. I think you can understand why that is not an acceptable way to bring the world together, especially now that China has past the United States as a major emitter of CO2 emissions. We need China to agree to binding contractual agreements to reduce carbon, and we need transparency to see whether they are achieving their objectives.
China has raised sovereignty concerns with a new reporting and verification system throughout the conference. Chinese delegates weren't available for a response, but in a press conference today, Indian Special Envoy on Climate Change, Shyam Saran, said developing countries are willing to be transparent with their emissions reductions.
As far as we are concerned, we have no difficulty. No developing country has any difficulty in accepting international scrutiny, accountability with respect to any action which we take for which there is international support in the form of technology, in the form of financial resources. No difficulty at all.
Saran called the emissions reporting and verification issue a red herring. He said a verification system is already in place under the Kyoto Protocol, and the move to create a new reporting system would be under a new non-binding agreement that weakens current law.
The real issue here is not verification of actions which have to be taken by developing countries. The real issue here is there are countries who are trying to get out of what are legally binding commitments today with an international enforcement mechanism and instead want to replace it with something which will be much more diluted.
The fact that the fate of the Kyoto Protocol remains a front burner issue even at this late stage reflects the seeming total lack of progress at this conference. The fear some are voicing now is that leaders will sign a meaningless statement in order to avoid leaving completely empty-handed. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Copenhagen.
And this breaking news from Jenny Johnson inside the Bella Center, negotiators say they've reached an agreement, and details are forthcoming. FSRN will continue to watch the story and bring you developments next week. And one of the topics being discussed in Copenhagen is the connection between gender and climate change. Experts are hoping to develop programs and policies that recognize the distinct impact climate change has on women, as well as the solutions women can bring to the table. FSRN's Diletta Varlese has more.
Lorena Aguilar is a gender advisor for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Aguilar and other gender experts say women have a big role to play in reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Women make 80% of the consumption decisions at the household level. And this is fundamental because if women are making decisions of what you have to buy, making decisions of how you're going to use the energy, can you imagine 80%? That's a tremendous amount of power to decide, for example, green products. What can you buy and where should you buy? What things you should not are supposed to eat or why you should not buy products that are coming from abroad at different time of the years. So this whole issue of climate change is about changing how we have been doing things at usually.
Women are also uniquely affected by natural disasters, often because they are denied access to information and education. Aguilar says a society's culture can limit a woman's ability to prepare for a disaster.
In those countries in which the gender gap is wider, the ratio of death is 4 to 1. For every 5 persons that die, 4 women are victims. Because, for example, they have never been taught how to swim, because in many countries, women are not supposed to put a bathing suit on. It has to do with mobility, basically due to the fact that women were not allowed to leave their homes without a male relative. So they rather drown in their houses before leaving it, because there is a social constraint.
Many here in Copenhagen are discussing adaptation or the adjustment in natural or human system in response to climate change. Some experts say many women are already at a disadvantage when it comes to adaptation. One example is in Bangladesh, where cyclone shelters lacked proper toilets. Many women, including those who were pregnant and breastfeeding, choose to brave the storm rather than go to a dirty, overcrowded shelter where they would have no privacy. Some of these women drowned. Indriani Guyapati is a professor at a Dhaka University in Bangladesh. She says adaptation policies must take gender into consideration.
But there is the very psychology that we don't think about the special needs of women. There are some special needs groups who requires some special adaptation measures. And that we call gender-sensitive adaptation. I'm working for Gender CC, and in Bangladesh, constantly we were lobbying with the government to change the design of the shelters.
Another issue is how climate change and population are connected. Last month, the United Nations released a report stating women could help fight climate change through a better access to contraception. But some women say reducing population won't necessarily reduce climate change. Hanna Lundell is an activist with Frei Frau, a multicultural network of women. She says this is a dangerous point of view.
The fact we have is that in industrialized countries, we have, you know, more efficient technologies and so on, but we have more consumption. That's the main effect we are facing. And that has nothing to do with population issues. It's our overconsumption. And also, it's politically not wise to link this, to link population and climate change issues. And also, I think it's dangerous because we don't want credits or whatever for contraceptives. I think that would be really dangerous because then women could be forced.
Many activists and researchers at the climate change talks in Copenhagen want to see gender as a prominent part of the final treaty. They also want rich countries to commit to funding programs that would specifically address gender and climate change. Diletta Varlese, FSRN, Copenhagen.
One important environmental issue that has received scant attention in Copenhagen is that of access to and use of clean water resources. Waterborne illnesses are a leading cause of death, killing more than 2 million people worldwide each year. That's according to the World Health Organization. Continued population growth has also strained the capacity of freshwater reserves to replenish themselves. But water conservationists say shrinking water supplies have more to do with how we use and distribute the vital resource. FSRN's Shannon Young takes a look at how some individuals are using household-level solutions to deal with the water crisis in Oaxaca, Mexico.
One place to see a gray water treatment system in action is at Tierra del Sol, a permaculture farm located about an hour outside of Oaxaca City. The farm's water technician, Lidia Aguado, takes me up a path towards the communal kitchen. The gray water treatment system is behind it, connected to a PVC pipe that comes out of the wall behind the kitchen sink.
El agua gris es la que proviene de la tarja.
Gray water is that which comes from the sink, the wash basin, the washing machine, the shower. And here we have this water and a grease trap, which works as the first filter to separate the grease from the water that we're going to treat.
Este es el agua que vamos a tratar.
The grease floats in the first barrel, while the grease-free water moves through a pipe to a second barrel. There, screens and gravel remove bits of food and other large particles. That water then goes to a large, subdivided square that resembles a checkerboard of gravel, charcoal, and plants.
It passes from one chamber to the next, filtering itself more each time. And in those final chambers, we have aquatic plants, plants whose roots work to filter the water.
After the filtration chambers, the water goes to a pond where it's stored for irrigation. Or the water can go to a gravel-filled ditch where it either evaporates into the air or seeps into the ground. Lydia says the farm returns all of its gray water to the environment and avoids sewage altogether through the use of composting toilets. Flush toilets do require huge amounts of fresh water, and people who have used them their entire lives are reluctant, if not unwilling, to explore alternatives.
I would say the general problem is a problem of social attitude.
Juan José Consejo is the director of the Institute of Nature and Society of Oaxaca, a non-governmental organization that promotes water conservation and alternative technologies. He says using fresh water to dilute and transport bodily waste is destructive and unsustainable.
We can use dry sanitation. And you would say that's something for the country. In fact, there's techniques to do it in a modern way. There are electrical toilets, dry toilets, for example. They have been starting to be used in Sweden, for example. And they don't have problems of water, but they are starting to worry about that problem.
Gray water treatment systems and dry toilets aside, environmentalists say do-it-yourself water conservation is as simple as harvesting rainwater and reusing gray water to flush toilets. And the pace of the talks in Copenhagen seemed to indicate that it's much faster to make changes at a household level than it is to wait for governments to adopt environmentally friendly policies. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And to see pictures of the project in Oaxaca, go to fsrn.org. There's another high-stakes negotiation happening on the sidelines in Copenhagen. Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev are getting close to a deal on nuclear weapons. It's been 2 weeks since the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, expired, which has guided bilateral disarmament since 1991. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports.
Despite intentions to have a new agreement in place before the old one expired, the two countries missed their deadline. The U.S. and Russia issued a statement expressing their mutual determination to continue in the spirit of the treaty, a kind of bridging agreement that keeps the two countries out of a nuclear no-man's land between deals. At a recent press conference, National Security Advisor James Jones assured reporters that a full follow-on treaty was on its way.
There's no reason to think that this won't be done, and the desire on both sides is very real and genuine.
Both sides report they're getting very close to a deal. Whatever they come up with will be significant partly because it takes the START treaty out of a Cold War context. The original treaty was signed just as the two countries were beginning to reestablish friendlier relations, but radical disarmament measures would have seemed irresponsible.
Now, there's a certain air of unreality about all of this. Right. I mean, everybody knows that a nuclear war is never going to get fought.
James Collins is former U.S. ambassador to Russia.
But you still have this whole world of people who will become very concerned if there's a sense that one side is getting some sort of predominance over the other. And therefore, the management of nuclear strategic weaponry, that is the kind of weaponry that could in fact destroy the other side in a way that provides in some sense increased assurance that it's never going to be used and that you know what the other side is up to, has been a fundamental part of the Russian-American relationship. Because we remain the only two countries that can destroy each other.
Some experts, including Ambassador Collins, say the U.S. and Russia need to prove they're serious about disarmament before other countries will follow suit next year when the more inclusive non-proliferation treaty is renegotiated. After all, the two countries together have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons, about 10,000 each. Obama made clear his own desire for reductions in an April speech in Prague.
So today, I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
Full elimination, however, is a long way off. Obama and Medvedev announced in July that the new treaty would set the reduction target at about 1,600 strategic warheads each, cutting about a third of their current stockpiles. The target for delivery vehicles, like missiles and airplanes, would be around 800. Tom Colina, research director of the Arms Control Association, says he hopes the next treaty negotiations after this will go even further, and not just in number.
But also take on an area of arms control that has yet been essentially untouched, which is tactical or short-range nuclear weapons that have never been the subject of a bilateral treaty such as the START treaties. And then we need to get into another issue that has never been fully explored, which is how do we verify the destruction of the warheads themselves?
Once the two presidents sign the treaty, it will have to go to the U.S. Senate and the Russian Duma for ratification. Though the partisan atmosphere in Washington has some nervous that it could be hard to get enough senators on the same side of anything, some experts say the negotiators have addressed concerns on all sides and that the treaty will likely go through. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Earlier today in northwestern Pakistan, a car bomb exploded near a mosque inside a police compound, killing 10 people and injuring an estimated 25. Most of the victims were police leaving the mosque after prayers. It's the second bombing against a mosque used by security forces in the last 2 weeks. Meanwhile, this week, Pakistan's Supreme Court struck down an amnesty deal that would have kept thousands of politicians, including President Asif Ali Zardari, immune from corruption charges. The decision has ramped up pressure on Zardari, and opposition leaders have called for him to step down. Joining us to discuss the events is Arif Rafiq. He's the editor of the Pakistan Policy blog, and in a November article on foreignpolicy.com, he analyzes the future of Zardari. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, this amnesty bill was put in place in 2007 to facilitate the return of Benazir Bhutto, Zardari's wife, who was assassinated in 2007. It's now 2 years later. Zardari is immune while he is in the presidency, but what does this do to his hold on power?
Well, it certainly weakens it. One, morally, it's another blow to his moral legitimacy. And what it also does is it attacks his political coalition, because the governing coalition, which he leads in Islamabad, has in fact is basically consists of many of the parties that benefited from this reconciliation ordinance, and it was what binded them together. And then also, while he has immunity, his many of his closest allies do not. So it puts them under the severe threat of arrest and prosecution, and so many of them might be inclined to resign from office.
Well, you mentioned other people who could be affected by this ruling as well. Some very high up officials, including the Minister of Defense, the Interior Minister, senior advisors to Zardari. So what's the broader effect of this?
Well, it certainly weakens, I think, the American hand in terms of Pakistani politics and its security affairs, because the Interior Minister and the Defense Minister and the ambassadors to London and Washington are these sort of four leading closest allies of Zardari, and they're also the most pro-American, pro-Western individuals inside the government today. And so what this does is it enables the Pakistan army to consolidate its control over security policy inside the country, and also you sort of manage this final stage of the American presence inside Afghanistan. Because the Pakistan army has been a partner of the United States in the war on terror, but at the same time, there's a big divide in terms of who both countries see as enemies and in terms of the sort of mid to long-term interest in the region.
And what does this latest development mean for the ongoing military offensive in South Waziristan and the U.S. war in Afghanistan? The U.S. has, of course, identified Pakistan as a key ally in the region. What could be happening next year?
Right. So in terms of that alliance, as opposed to, let's say, working with both the civilian government and the army at the same time, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is going to be one that is, that is marked by an extreme level of influence from the Pakistan army. So in the end, Washington's objectives inside Pakistan are mainly security and military, and in terms of engaging with the local actors, the relevance of the civilian politicians has decreased significantly, and the military's importance has increased radically. And also, in terms of the Pakistan Army's leverage over the United States, it has also increased. And so, in terms of the U.S. operations inside southern Afghanistan, those supplies for the 20,000 plus troops that are going there are going to be coming through Pakistan. And so, in terms of, the United States would like Pakistan to expand its operations against some Afghan actors that aren't necessarily a challenge to Pakistan, and the Pakistan Army has been reluctant to do so. And that reluctance will maintain because the Pakistan Army has no interest in doing that, and it has this leverage, whether it's in terms of the supply routes and these other things, to just say no to Washington.
We've been speaking with Arif Rafiq about developments this week in Pakistan. Arif Rafiq is the editor of the Pakistan Policy Blog and president of Vizier Consulting, a consulting firm on Middle East and South Asian political and security issues. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, an update to Tanya Snyder's coverage earlier this week on the low-power FM bill in Congress. The House passed the bill late Wednesday. It now heads to the Senate. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Tanya Snyder. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.